from the time that they pronounced me dead was a good 45 minutes.
They cut my clothes and then they paddled my heart because my heart had stopped. And I could see people screaming and crying, but I didn't realize that was actually my physical body because I was somewhere else.
The only thing that I could feel, if you can imagine, absolute love and peace. There wasn't anything else to be felt.
I was greeted by people I had known in the past.
I'm back home again.
Incredibly safe and felt at home.
Welcome, welcome to Round Trip Death, everybody. And a special welcome from way out in Long Island, Jacob Cooper. Good morning, Jacob.
Good morning, Eric. You know, it's a pleasure to be on your podcast. I love the work that you do.
Well, thank you. And I had a friend, a good friend once upon a time from Long Island, only he pronounced it Long Island.
Yeah, there's a lot of heavy accents around here. I hope I don't come off too strong within any conversation. My hope is to come off as neutral as possible, but you know, you could take the man out of the Long Islander, but I guess the Long Islander can't come out of the man, so some of that always comes out.
Don't pretend. Let it all out. We love it. Hey, before we jump into your near-death experience, I would love for our listeners to get to know you a little bit. If you would just take 1 minute and give us a little bit of background, who is Jacob?
Oh, wow, gosh, that's a very deep question. It's an evolving answer by the minute, by the day, but I try to stay as someone who is here to hopefully help others remember who they are. I'm always asked how I want to be remembered, and I think myself, it's not that important. It's more so, I guess, through the work that people are able to remember how unique, special, and hopefully eternal we all are, and certainly having a profound NDE at a young age put me in that pathway. But I also work in the mental health field as a therapist. I do a lot of hypnotherapist, and I'm sure we'll discuss some of the particulars of hypnosis that I utilize, as well as a lot of public speaking. And I've written 2 published books just at the right around the age of 32 years old. Both books were published. And so I'm working on a third book to come. But I guess I'm someone who just likes to generate the hope past the pain and to derive inspiration as much as I can in times of need, and hopefully more of a unity and empowerment to those that I come into cross with.
Well, you're being very humble. I know you're a best-selling author. Go ahead and plug your 2 books. Give us the names.
Well, sure. And maybe I could try the visuals. Well, the first book that I wrote is Life After Breath. And the second book is The Wisdom of Jacob's Ladder. And both are available on Amazon, paperback, Kindle, as well as audio. My first book was endorsed by my good friend, Dr. Raymond Moody. You know, he was one of the individuals, if you don't know, who coined the term near-death experience in his best-selling book, Life After Life, from the 70s. The Life After Breath is more of what I call my karma, or the story of my near-death experience. And The Wisdom Jacob's Ladder includes some of the karma, but it's more about the dharma, which is, to me, the meaning, the essence of the lessons of my near-death experience. So they're both helpful for a lot of viewers, a lot of readers, rather, and I've gotten a lot of, you know, nice feedback and emails for the most part. So again, it's just a pleasure to give something back. And, you know, I don't know about you, Eric, but I think there's a big correlation between pain and purpose. And, you know, when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I probably lived mostly in the library, or at least reading books that, you know, anything I could get my hands on, you know, that was inspiring, that was uplifting, I'd want to delve into. And it came when I was just at a lot of times moments of uncertainty and when I felt very low. And I said, you know, thought to myself, geez, I don't want to be buried in a cemetery. I want to be buried on these shelves with these authors and, you know, my books to be there. And hopefully, you know, down the road, they'll still have libraries when I'm at that old age. But, you know, I think really we're here to make a ripple effect in our lives. And you're doing that every time a podcast comes out and just by being you. So thank you for the great work that you're doing, getting this information out to the public. You're really making a ripple effect.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Moody. He's been on the show. He is awesome. He's getting up there in years, but he still has plenty of energy. He was rocking so fast that the microphone almost couldn't pick him up. And I know Ions is doing some kind of a documentary about him this year. So we're looking forward to that also.
Is that right? Yeah. New news to me. I didn't hear that, but well deserved for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is the 50th anniversary of the book and him coining the term near-death experience. So
wow.
Anyway, let's jump right into it. And your experience happened when you were very young. And one of the things I'm going to be asking you in a minute is, how do you even remember it from 3 years old? So lead us, tell us what happened, what led up to it.
Absolutely, Eric. Well, September of 1993, to give my age away, I was just the young age of 3 years old. At this time, I didn't know this, or none of my family knew this. I had a condition called whooping cough, otherwise known as pertussis, which for those familiar with it medically, I mean, it could be fatal or very detrimental to one's health, particularly if you're an infant or child, or even, you know, in adult years, you know, if left untreated. I had whooping cough, didn't know this, went to a playground with family friends, and this is kind of the short of it. The more extended versions are obviously included in my books, but I climbed a ladder going to a slide, just began to suffocate due to this coughing spree, and everything in my brain and my body just shut down, as if you're in a basement, and if you're a homeowner, you can understand, just shut off one unit at a time, and there's nothing you can do. The units are just shutting off. You're very powerless to it. And then all of a sudden, my body, I just knew, was not working. So rather than being in a car that's not going to start or not going to work, you know, I just was able to leave my body, and I was able to have awareness of it physiologically. And then all of a sudden, I felt my brain, and I just saw that it was deprived of oxygen, just felt it just slowly just going away. Then all of a sudden, I felt this large crack within my brain due to the deprivation of oxygen. And there's a saying in the English language that says, my brain cracked open and God came in. And this literally happened to me. This wasn't some euphemism where I felt my brain just completely crack open. And that's when everything opened up. I had a lot of the classical euphoric, near-death experience, mystical experience that Raymond Moody highlights in his book, including tunnel, feeling euphoric, you know, rising up, feeling vibrations, angels around me, spirit guides that I was able to see, soul family members, awareness of past lives, premonitions of the work that I would do. So it was a tremendous panoramic viewpoint of the life that I lived, that included past lives, as well as this potential journey that I was going to continue on, you know, in my life as a three-year-old moving forward. But it certainly is profound, and obviously we could get more in some of the finer details of it. Regarding, you know, one of your first questions as to how this is able to be remembered, there's several points of reference that I could point to. Certainly within my credibility as a mental health therapist, I could point to the traumatic conditions at play. For those who might have competency of trauma, they'll understand that trauma has a disassociative component, meaning that something is so profound for your mind, or in this case, spirit, to hold on to, that it just kind of shields itself from remembering it due to protection. But eventually that could come out within the right timing. Or trauma could have the clearest of recall, you know, as if there hasn't been any time and space from that event. And certainly I don't want to sugarcoat it as beautiful and euphoric as my NDE was in crossing over to the other side. It was as equally as scary and traumatic through suffocation and losing all of control of my own human breath. But I think that was a gift in a way. That was a gift beyond the trauma, the ability to remember it, as well as this was an experience that went beyond the production or the storage of my finite brain. As I said before, my brain was totally deprived of oxygen, had zero functioning whatsoever. And so this was really a subconscious experience of my higher mind and soul. And so there are people that I work with now, and we'll get into this, who have memories that go far beyond this lifetime. You know, so to me, memory does not have an expiration date. Oftentimes, kids, in fact, are able to remember a lot more of events prior to coming to this body because they're less in their, I would say, analytical minds or linear minds, and they're more in tune with their spirits, which just gets here from the other side. But yes, there's a certain cutoff of amnesia that a lot of people have, usually around age 5 or 6, where they forget a lot of things. So I know I impact a lot over there, but yeah, I'd be feel free to fire away with questions or any of the skeptics' point of view. We'll do the best we can. I don't know necessarily cynics, because that's almost impossible to move, but skeptics is a very healthy place to start with.
Well, I don't want to jump into skeptic mode. I rarely do that anyway, because I tend to believe the people that I have on the show here. But I do want lots more detail. You gave a great summary, but start from the beginning. And I realize it would probably take hours to fill in every detail. But you mentioned the classic things like the tunnel. Is that the best place to start? I want much more detail.
Yeah, you know, Eric, to answer your question, the tunnel, I don't know necessarily the best place to start. I would say the power or the pathway of surrender is the best place to start. I, at this time, was suffocated during my NDE. And, you know, you could imagine like you're drowning and there's nothing to hold on to. And, you know, oxygen, being able to breathe in oxygen keeps us going in this body. Without it, what are we unless we're on some type of breathing machine or ventilator? And so that was totally deprived of me. There was nothing to hold on to. So I kept on trying to struggle to breathe. I remember this, you know, in this very clearly, and there was nothing to hold on to. So it felt like I was drowning and there wasn't a log or anything to hold on to. And all of a sudden, I just felt myself just surrendering to something else. And in my books, I call that the breath of eternity, and which, you know, to me is a light of the other side. It's just this power that we all have, this spark of eternity that we all have. So rather than trying to struggle against what was, I surrendered to this infinite power, this eternal power that we all have. And once I stopped the struggle and I surrendered, you know, that's when I was able to really let go of the struggle. And then euphoria opened up once I got out of this darkness of the tunnel and really entered the light. And I felt my spirit rising at an infinite speed and rate, as if, you know, you're on a roller coaster ride and there's no beginning, middle, or end or limitation with how fast you're soaring on this ride. I could sense vibrations and frequencies. But the feeling that I got was, and this is kind of hard for viewers to understand, you see, in our reality, the colors, for example, are limited by the rays of the sun, and that's the reference that we have. When you're on the other side, you're not physical. You're dealing with the non-material. And so a lot of the factors that are over there are nearly impossible or very difficult to articulate, but I do the best I can at each dialogue or conversation that I have, because that's the task at hand. But I felt this incredible euphoria. And when I was able to feel this euphoric vibe, in our world, for instance, we're used to something happening, but we almost have a cap with how good we could feel because we're bioneurochemical still. On the other side, there was no limitations with how euphoric and good that I felt. There was no limitations of that. And that's hard for many to conceptualize or understand. We're used to like, all right, I have that great situation, but there's always seems to be a cap of that. And the other side, there was no ending of how good, you know, I was feeling. Like I said, moments later, I was able to really get a sense and feelings of the other side. It was just this beautiful euphoric light realm and this high vibrational frequency. This earth is a lot lower of a density, a lot lower of a frequency. When you cross over the other side, the vibrations are a lot more intensified. And I think it was Albert Einstein who said, we are all just energy that could never be created nor destroyed. And at the end of the day, the other side is just a higher energetic frequency. There's a frequency of the afterlife, and it's just right above this reality. Moments later, to provide a little bit more context, I felt to the right side of my brain, which I now know corresponds to creativity. I was able to see this immaculate palace behind me, and this light was so bright. It was so bright and powerful that my spirit just almost had to shield itself because it was so powerful. And, you know, I think when people think of the other side, they think you just kind of go there and you're already there and that's it. But from my experience, I could say that there was a bit of an adjustment phase to crossing over. It took some time to really get familiarized with it. And yes, it was home, but it was such a profound transition that it took some time for my spirit to really get used to, just in terms of its beauty, its potency from this physical reality. We're used to limited, and you get to the unlimited, it's familiar, yet at the same time overwhelming. But when I was looking at this beautiful palace, to me, I just had this knowing that it was a representation of the eternal creative force of all of life itself, which some people denote religious terms to it. They call it God. Others will call it the universe. Some just creation, whatever you want to label it as. Your words are limiting, you know, because it doesn't do justice to what I saw. You know, words are most powerful tool we have in this reality, but they cannot possibly conceptualize, you know, how beautiful and profound that light was. And instantaneously, when I was in that light, when I was looking at this palace, I was able to see angels around it. I was able to feel unconditional understanding, you know, and a lot of things dissipated, all regarding a lot of fears that I had. And all of a sudden, you know, on the other side, I felt I was able to see this eternal horizon of a sky that was in my awareness, and was able to feel this incredible frequency of vibration. And I think of reality, we think of reality, think of levels of vibrational frequency, you think of energy. And this frequency was one of the highest octaves of frequency on the other side that was accessible. And this frequency was what I call the Christ frequency, or the Christ consciousness that I was able to be tuned into. Bear in mind, I grew up Jewish, so certainly Jesus was Jewish as well. But 3 years old, it wasn't something that I was educated at all, you know, ever in my background. So some of the things that happened in my NDE go way beyond any exposure that I had, which isn't congruent with a lot of people who've had near-death experiences, as people who are visually impaired all of a sudden could see, or people who are auditorily impaired could hear. I wasn't exposed to any of this stuff in my early life, but there was a deep familiarity. And then all of a sudden, I just had questions where, what would my life look like? And how would my parents, you know, deal with a kid crossing over? And I just wanted to know, like, the story didn't seem complete, and I wanted to know what it would look like. And a lot of those fears dissipated. And when I was in this frequency, I had this inner knowing of all is well, was well, will be well. And there was no conceptualization of time. And this is very congruent with what Lao Tzu said, that he said in the past, there's a lot of promoted sadness. In the future, there's a lot of promoted anxiety. But in the present, you know, that's where you could find peace. And in this moment on the other side, all I felt was this infinite wave of eternal peace with no, in this timelessness that many near-death experiencers talk about. And I just was aware that no matter what happened, there was a point where I and my parents and all those who knew me in this life would meet. It would be that same point, regardless of what happened, if I decided to stay or go in my near-death experience, that all souls would connect. But then I just was curious as to what my life would look like and why I'm here. And all of a sudden, I felt my guides with me, and they came down with me, and I saw to the right and the left side of me a male and female guardian angel or spirit guide. And it's the one detail of my near-death experience, for whatever reason, that I seem to have a blockage of, just in terms of their names. At the time, I knew their names instantaneously, and they were the most beautiful beings that you could ever, you know, imagine. But when, you know, my two primary guides were with me, I felt a sense of exhalation. I felt a sense of, wow, you know, they are with us all the time. And sometimes we have our blinders on. But life is a lot more wider and panoramic than we give it credit to. And my guides were with me this whole journey, you know, being, you know, this young child. And they were there with every step. But I just had my blinders on at times in my life that I forgot that and just thought that I was alone. And then slowly I had people surrounding me at the playground that I was at, and they kept on calling my name. But I felt to the side of myself, I felt my spirit form, my body was just there, irresponsive and lifeless. And I wanted to shake everyone from the other side to let them know that I was okay, that I'm fine. It was just a little bit of torture where I could see them and they couldn't see me. But then I was able to see right in front of my eyes this infinite array of angels that were floating right in front of me. And these were different than the guardian angels or spirit guides. It's like kind of like England, whether we want to call it England or the UK, it kind of describes the same place, just different terms. But the angels that I saw were very young, very youthful. They're almost like infant looking in their presentation. And they had a lot more uniformity, whereas the spirit guides had their own distinctive characteristics. The angels that I saw were just a thin veil right in front of my eyes. And I almost had to pinch myself because they were right there. And it's as if we have this reality and you just tune up the frequency of this reality a little bit. Angels are all around us all the time in this thin veil of separation. They are with us all around us. Hundreds of thousands of angels were there. And they were kind of like a golden-like color. Whereas the guides were very micro-focused on myself, the angels that I saw were just looking in the distance. They weren't looking at me, but they were sending warmth and energy and love to the planet and the situation. And they were all around us and just looking right at them. And I just had to like pinch myself because it felt too good to be true, as familiar as it was. Slowly, I was able to see a lot of beings that came into my awareness from the other side. Some would call this the soul family. You know, others would call it nuclear family. I think we're all a part of a soul family, but we all have a caste that we're a part of in terms of different acts, but it's all just kind of different plays that we're contracted to.
We'll get into a bunch more questions later. I just one quick thing I wanted to ask about that. Did you recognize any of the people from this family? Did you feel like you knew them?
Absolutely. And even, you know, there were individuals that I was very much, you know, because I think people think of soul families just biological, people that were in your nuclear family. But a lot of the soul family that I was in contact with came through when I was a teacher on the other side, and I was able to see a lot of students, you know, in that life that came through that I was really had a profound soul connection with in that last lifetime. So yes, a lot of these beings were ancestors that I knew in this life and beyond, but also they came from that, you know, prior life. But there was a sense of familiarity. But there was also a degree of shame and embarrassment to a degree because this wasn't their judgment. The other side, there's no judgment. I didn't feel that. I felt they were looking up at me rather down at me. You know, that's more of a human construct. There's a lot of dichotomy and difference between this reality and that reality, where that reality, you are loved and almost looked up to for who you are, not what you do, which could change minute to minute. And we're constantly judged over here, but we're constantly loved over there. And there's no limit for that. You're loved for your being rather than your doing, in a sense. But in terms of what I was able to see from that scene, I was also able to see spirit guides and, you know, angels in aura colors around all the people that were around me. And bear in mind, a lot of people that were with me on that day were not like the Dalai Lama, you know, on face value, or Gandhi. They were just, you know, regular CPA type people and working people. And, you know, looking back on that, it just reminded me that all is spiritual. At the end of the day, that's our core, that's our phyla. Some remember that, some are emboldened in that, some maybe forget that. But you take an orange, you squeeze it out, you get orange juice. And you take who we are, you squeeze it out, you get an infinite spirit beyond a lot of the separations that some, you know, may be connecting to in their current life or lives. But there was a point in time where I just asked a simple question, again, which is, you know, why am I here? Which is the most common question that I'm asked in any presentation that I do. You know, and if I do stay, like, what is my purpose? What will my life look like? And all of a sudden, I was given what's called a life review, which many people are familiar with. I'm sure a skeptic, I'm feeling that, you know, listening would say, or anyone would say, geez, that must have been the shortest film of all time. You're just 3 years old. What I would counter to that is the other side is much different than this side, where in a sense that it's not a matter of the chronological years of our life, but rather the degree of life within those years. And so it felt like I chronologically lived 3 years, but those 3 years felt like a long time, just in terms of the experiences that I had, the love that I shared, the connections that I had. And so time over there is much different over here. There are people who have lived 100 years, but barely lived one day over here. You know, so it's all about the experiences that we have and the love that we are able to have. But this life review was more so from the perspective of the people around me and just understanding the love that we shared and had. But it also transcended this life, and it went to other different incarnations that I had, other different lifetimes. So this life review included other past lives. And I saw myself spanning the globe, traveling a lot of different cultures and countries and civilizations. And the most distinctive lifetime that has a lot of parallels to my NDE, which I'm sure may bring up some degrees of sensitivities for viewers, given the subject matter and how it all went down, was a life that was actually evidentially read for me by different intuitives and psychics prior to me ever becoming public with my NDE. And this has been evidentially read for me, but a life in which I completed suicide. I don't use the word commit because I don't criminalize, you know, that decision, nor does the other side. You know, that's more of like a human judgment of it. But this was this last lifetime that I lived in which I felt like the walls were caving in. There was nothing again once to hold on to. And I felt that was it. And, you know, all of a sudden I made that decision. I just saw the life between lives of that lifetime in my NDE. And I saw that I wasn't judged. I was embraced. And there wasn't condemnation. But I was able to see from completion we begin. And there was a big tie that I felt from my NDE and that situation, where in my NDE, I was once again faced with a similar degree of proverbial and literal suffocation. But what I did this time differently than that last lifetime was I surrendered to the power within, and I remembered who I was and what I was connected to in the midst of the deepest and darkest of winter. As Albert Camus said, within me, I found an eternal and infinite summer. And that was, you know, a lesson that I know was from my NDE. And slowly but surely, I had premonitions of myself speaking in front of a lot, you know, large crowd of people. And I was able to really see that this wasn't speaking as if from the ego perspective that I'm this big fancy schmancy speaker and I'm better than people. No, it was just that when I was speaking, I was able to see that I was one with the audience and getting this message out of allowing people to really remember who they are, like the show started. And, you know, in that moment, I said, as beautiful as the other side is, you know, because I was given autonomy to stay or go, this capacity to bring it into this reality, this proverbial way of bringing heaven down to earth, is not something that I could pass on. And it's something potentially even more glorious than the other side, you know, of an opportunity. Within that decision, I chose to stay from that commitment to my soul's contract. And then slowly but surely, I found myself, you know, in a hospital bed, rushed by the ambulance, and, you know, the rest is kind of history.
Whew. That's a lot. That is awesome. Thank you for sharing all of that. It strikes me so, I don't know, really interesting that as a three-year-old, when you were on the other side, your brain was working like an adult. I think when I was 3 years old here, my thoughts were Captain Crunch, riding my trike, you know, rolling a ball, whatever. But you were thinking about the big stuff. Mm-hmm. How do you think that worked? Why did that happen?
I would say that two things could be true at the same time. Well, there's an undeniable truth that we have a part of ourselves that's in congruency with our chronological age of development and the temporary experiences that we have. That's just one page of the book. That's not the entire book or other chapters. And when you cross over to their side, you're more in tune with your infinite spirit rather than the projections or limitations of your own chronological age. So I'll give you an example. For instance, we may know a lot of people who are the aged population or senior citizens who might have a lot of physical or, you know, mental or maybe psychological you know, limitations. And oftentimes when they cross over to their side, they come through in readings, they're young, they're free, they have a knowingness to them. They're not limited by the temporary stages that they were going through in that part of their life. So I think what we have in our lives are different experiences, but those are not the full totality of our soul. You know, and all this life is just, to me, just an experience of the soul. We are infinite, eternal spiritual beings having these temporary human experiences. So I think a lot of people attach themselves with where they are temporarily and what they're going through, and that's just an experience. It's not the full story of the soul's journey. And so crossing over and having my NDE, I was able to be more in tune with the soul rather than the experiences of the ego or the temporary experiences of this human journey.
Right. It's like your full-grown, experienced adult spirit was back. It wasn't held back by only being having a three-year-old brain attached to it. Am I kind of getting that right?
Yeah, and okay. And this will sound controversial, but I don't believe that any soul that we have is 3 years old. I think all souls are eternal. It just takes some time for the soul and the body to have congruency and to work with each other. But it's not like, all right, you live another 10 years, all of a sudden the soul has evolved, you know, 50 to 100 years. It just takes time for the two to be in harmony. And so just because you don't see it or just because it's not said does not mean a young infant isn't connecting on one level to the depths of their souls. There's just what we see is the surface of the portrayal, which is, you know, by the instrument that we're using of the body. But that awareness is always there, despite it not necessarily being tapped into at a certain point in time. But then there comes a time where people remember who they are by oftentimes letting go of who they thought they were.
Makes sense. Another thing that I found kind of interesting in some of the words that you use the word surrender a few times. And people that I have interviewed that have had drowning experiences use similar terms. And I wonder if that's because when your oxygen is, for you, your oxygen was cut off, for someone drowning, same thing. And it's sort of this coming to realize, okay, I can't breathe right now, and in a little time from now, I'm still not going to be able to breathe. This whole thing about breathing is just over. And the brain quickly processes that, and probably the spirit too. And then as you call it, surrender, and there's probably 10 other words that we could give to it. But I find that very interesting that's a very similar thing, because I think you have a little bit of time to process it compared to maybe someone who's killed in a, you know, violent traffic accident or who knows what. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably say the majority of people tend to have suffocation, and it's like a slow, painful situation. But you're right, some people it's like very quick, and there's no time of incubation to go into that phase. So there was a degree of incubation between life and death, you know, that I had. And but the term surrender is always something that comes to mind. And that's quite a pathologized word in many ways, because a lot of people think surrender is giving up. But I think the inverse, that it's really giving in and tapping into your power. And it's so pivotal in today's world, you know, with people in recovery and AA and NA, just the power of surrender to the higher power, deeper power within, to really be in partnership, you know, with your changes of your life.
Yeah, this is a good kind of surrender. This isn't, I failed, I'm giving up.
No.
This is, yes, I realize where I'm at, and I'm joining in the whole experience that's happening now. It's a good way to put it. I want to hear more about your guides. And I'm sorry you can't remember their names, but what else can you tell me about them?
Well, what I would say is, imagine the most beautiful individual that you know, and hopefully if you're married, that's a spouse, but you know, maybe if not, that's maybe someone else. And there's an inner and outer beauty that just goes beyond descriptive words. It's beyond anything that you could articulate. And imagine that person that you have such a degree of admiration for, and you see such an infinite degree of beauty, sees the same in you. And, you know, oftentimes we think if something is so beautiful and so great that we'll put that on a pedestal and we'll say, okay, that's for someone else great, but it's not for me. Like, who am I to go to that ivory tower? And so the beauty that I saw was reflected also from the guides to myself and all of us. And so they see us in such a different light than how we see ourselves. But I just remembered, A, just how physical beautiful they were, how they were with me the whole time. And just the degree of the blinders that I had within my human life that wasn't always seeing them and connecting to them. And I think that's within reason. I think we're here to have the human experience. And if we're just living on the other side all the time, you know, and we're so connected, it's very hard for us to really live this life. As well as if you're given all the answers to the test, you're not going to grow as much and work hard. So I think there's a deal of toil, challenges, resilience, and the evolution of the soul that happens in this lifetime. I would say that a little bit with the guides that I saw, that they were right with me to the right side and left side of me. And it was just a tremendous reunion. You know, I just felt just so embraced and so loved. And it was just a reconnection with beings that were with me all the time. In terms of their origins, in terms of our origins, that to me is not necessarily clear. I do feel there's a strong past life connection, or at least energetic connection that we all have with our guides. I say there's a magneticism in our lives. So for instance, birds of the feather will flock together and people have a vibe which will attract our tribe. And I think to the same way, the guides that we have within our life, just there's something about us that resonates with guides. And I do believe that a lot of spirit guides have lived lives over here versus angels. They have not had any incarnations. The angels, at least that I saw, you know, they're always been angels. But I think spirit guides, to me, have had journeys over here and they've evolved through, you know, these lives on Earth.
Speaking of past lives, we're going to jump topics a little bit here. And this is something we haven't really talked about much on this show previously, but I know you have a good knowledge of it. But we've heard the term past life regression. Give us a very brief syllabus. What is that and what can it do for people?
Absolutely. You know, past life regression is a very safe, non-invasive, you know, pretty easy form of hypnosis. You know, and really all it does is help people tap into the higher mind. Some may call it the subconscious mind. But again, you know, past life regression is a way for us to really get in touch with our libraries that we have and the many different chapters of journeys that we've had here on Earth, and to really access higher information from that library. Some may call that the Akashic Records. Some may call it the Hall of Wisdom. There's a lot of different vernaculars for all these things, but essentially it takes you from your limited finite mind and opens up yourself to access information beyond your finite mind. And past life regression really does help people to tap into different lifetimes that usually have significance or overlay within this lifetime that are valuable to visit. A lot of people come to me for different rationale behind a past life regression. Some are looking for it for more of a curiosity, entertainment perspective, you know, or some, they may feel that they do not know why they're here. They want, you know, a lot of guidance in their life. And some may have a lot of untapped trauma that they can't sort out no matter how much they see, you know, psychotherapists like myself. There's something that they're holding on to in a subconscious level they can't seem to get to the bottom of, you know. So past life regression is great to really, in terms of getting the roots of, and as well as finding some healing so we're no longer repeating similar regurgitated patterns and we're able to evolve from understanding our own history. You know, it's kind of like you look at, you know, psychological history or the planet's history. Without awareness of those behaviors, we tend to regurgitate those behaviors throughout thousands of years on this planet, as we're seeing now with all the world wars going on and people going against each other. I mean, it's just all the stuff with technological evolution. Spiritual evolution collectively has improved, but it's not fully there, obviously. And it's still a lot of pockets regurgitating similar behaviors. And so with awareness, we have the capacity to really change behaviors and to make better, more evolved, you know, decisions that will allow the spirit to really be more expansive and more evolved within their journeys. But it is profound, and it's very gentle, it's guided, it's safe, and it's effective. And the worst case scenario from a regression that one can have is many times they remember through going into past lives that they weren't condemned in hell, that they're eternal. And I think in a way the church hit a lot of, well, religion itself hit a lot of reincarnation because of fear that people will know that, hey, I don't go to hell, I'm reborn. So all of your fear-mongering that tells me I'm going to go to hell if I don't follow your rules is out the window, because that's what people will experience in past lives, that there's no real hell. We continue on, and there's other opportunities here in this earth school of life.
You mentioned earlier growing up Jewish, and you were only 3 years old, and that was all you had been exposed to. Do you mind, and if this is too personal, that's okay. You don't have to answer. But do you mind telling us how this has affected your religiosity? Religiosity, what is that word I'm looking for? Religiosity.
Religiosity.
Yes, going forward.
You know, as a kid, I was very much brought up in a very dogmatic circumstance where, I don't know, you had to, if you're a female and your skirt is one inch a little bit short, you know, you're ridiculed. The pots and pans need to be separated if it's meat and milk. You have to wait 6 hours, not 5 hours, between 80. So there was a lot of these rituals and laws and dogma that just didn't resonate. And so I think in a way I was a pretty big rebel against this outwardly and inwardly, and I never really bought into this. But again, part of what I believe is key is learning flexibility and adaptability. And I know the thing that Charles Darwin highlighted in Survival of the Fittest, that it wasn't the strongest, necessarily the smartest that survived. It was those who were most adaptable that were able to survive. And in my childhood, to survive, I had to bury a lot of the stuff in myself and keep it within. Otherwise, it would just be an exhausting all-out war against, you know, all these oppositions. And so there was a degree of radical acceptance that I had, as well as at times picking my battles. But I never really bought into it despite accepting it. And so that was a big part of it. But there's a big monopolization on spirituality, the afterlife within all of religion. And I say, spirituality in the afterlife does not exist because of religion. It exists despite of it, in a way. And religion does not have a monopoly on spirituality. It's just one way of understanding it. But for some, it could be the total antithesis of anything that's spiritual, because it falls in love in more of a God that I think it's interpreted in man's image versus a God understood in our image, in a way.
Okay. I'd like to wrap up with this. This is a two-part question coming at you. Part one is, this happened to you when you were only 3 years old. That makes you different than most three-year-olds and other kids and teenagers growing up. So I want to know how this affected your life. And then let's leave everybody with a message of hope that came from your life being this way.
Great question, Eric. Well, the subscription for most children and infants is to fit in, is to give your power to adults around you, that you're very little, you know nothing, and just self-abandon yourself and give your power over to people who are bigger than you or you feel you know more. So from the onset, there's a suppression and a disempowerment that most infants and children do face. They're not told that, hey, you have the answers. You're told, hey, we have the answers, and abandon yourself to really get on board. And the other thing is, most infants and children are prescribed to be normal. What does that mean? Well, normal in many ways is just self-abandoning yourself to fit in with what the leaf and water is, what the tide is in front of you, what everyone else is doing. And so I think to survive, that's something that I needed to do, you know, because I remember being a kid and having all these incredible interdimensional communications, which often is an after effect of near-death experience, particularly with all the brain changes that happened after my NDE. But I saw that to survive Yeah, you know, I needed to accept that I was a kid. Oftentimes I was called weird by other kids, or just people just didn't know what to make of me growing up. And so I self-abandoned myself. But I would say is to learn from those who are about to cross over back to their one-way ticket back home, no pun intended. And one of the top five regrets that people have is usually that they were someone else's image of who they wanted them to be, or society's priorities of who they wanted to be, versus being empowered enough to be themselves. And so I think if anything else, to be weird, to be different, to be yourself, you know, that is what's going to change the world. You know, no normal person really ever added to anything. I think we're all unique. While we're all one, we all have a unique note to add to this. So sing your song, dance your dance, you know, say your story. Stop worrying about what other people are going to think of it, because no matter what, people will love you, people will hate you, and very little of it will actually have to do with you. As one of the four agreements of Don Miguel Ruiz says, you know, to not take life personally. So really to know how to live, how to begin life from understanding from those who are at the end of it, and to not give your power over to those around you, and to not be just a clown to entertain people or to satisfy people with who they want you to be. But we're all here. Part of our life's purpose is to remember who we are, to be unique additions to this world, and to be unique. That's what will be remembered. That's what will last. And so weird and odd people are those who change the world. Normal people, you know, are never remembered. They don't add. So be different, be daring. That is the coolest thing you could do once you are connected, if that makes sense.
Great wisdom from Jacob Cooper. Thank you, Jacob. Appreciate you being with me today.
An honor. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thanks again for listening and sharing this podcast. Don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button and sign up for our newsletter at roundtripdeath.com. If you want to share your near-death experience, or if you have questions or comments about the show, send an email to eric@roundtripdeath.com. Until then, I wish you everything good that you're looking for in this life and the next.